Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest Republican presidential debate and the continuing Donald Trump phenomenon that has the reality star turned populist politician again rewarded for bad behavior as he rises in the polls after childish displays of name-calling insults leveled at his rivals on stage. Thomas Edsel, a professor of journalism at Columbia University and a New York Times columnist on demographic and strategic trends in American politics, joins us to discuss his op-ed in The Times, "Can This Really Be Donald Trump's Republican Party?" and a GOP that is too in tune with the donor class and not connecting with the concerns of regular voters who Donald Trump is appealing to. Then we'll look into the deep state, or the double government, that runs the daily business of national security, rendering those we elect in our faux democracy largely ornamentation, which explains why there is little difference between the presidencies of George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Michael Glennon, a professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, who was legal counsel to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, joins us to discuss how presidential control, congressional oversight, and judicial review of national security is largely illusory as the permanent national security establishment continues to expand its dominance of national priorities and its grip over the Treasury. Then finally, we'll speak with Laurie Wallach, the director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch and an expert on the operations and outcomes of trade policies such as NAFTA, WTO, and the TPP. We'll examine the attack on consumer protections in the omnibus spending bill making its way through Congress that eliminates country of origin meat labels for pork and beef that consumers rely on to make informed choices about their food. And joining us now is Thomas Edsel, a professor of journalism at Columbia University. His column on demographic and strategic trends in American politics appears every Wednesday in the New York Times. And during the years leading up to the 2012 elections, he wrote for the New York Times as a weekly contributor to Campaign Stops. He is the author of Power and Money, Writing About Politics, The New Politics of Inequality, and his latest book is The Age of Austerity. He has an op-ed at the New York Times, "Can This Really Be Donald Trump's Republican Party?" Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Edsel.
Good to be back with you.
And the punditry, of course, is basically using, I think, both before and after the last night's Republican presidential debate, a lot of boxing analogies about knockout punches and laying a glove on each other and all this kind of stuff. But essentially, to indulge that fetish for a moment, who do you think won the debate?
I thought Cruz did pretty well. I don't think anyone won it, put it that way. I thought Cruz did well. Rubio was very articulate. He had problems, though, with immigration. Trump was kind of laid back, but he always seems to go up no matter what his performance is. I thought Ben Carson did not do well. He's continuing his downward slide, and I think he's going to fall way down slowly to the lower tier of candidates. Kasich did not do what he needed to do. Jeb Bush improved, but he's got a long way to go to get back into real contention.
And do you think that the kind of schoolboy spat between Jeb Bush and Donald Trump hurt both of them? I think in a rational world, it should have.
Well, not to be too disparaging, but the Republican primary contest is not the rational world. I think Jeb Bush may have gained some in just showing some assertiveness, which has been his big problem. And Trump, his comeback was pretty childish, but you just have to say with him that things that you would expect to be problematic just don't ever seem to be, and he's now in the New York Times and Washington Post in very credible polls. He's flying high nationally. He's got some problems in Iowa, but beyond that, he's looking quite strong.
Well, I thought some of his, I mean, the point that you make in your article in the New York Times, "Can This Really Be Donald Trump's Republican Party?" is that you quote a prominent Republican strategist and lobbyist, John Feary, that our guys are too in tune with donors and not with the concerns of regular voters, and Donald Trump has tapped into a new reality. The fact that, of course, he's self-financed and all of the others have to sort of grovel before Sheldon Adelson, whose casino hosted the event last night. That, I think, probably does resonate. But also, for example, when Trump talked about what a catastrophe the Iraq war was, which, of course, always makes life difficult for Jeb Bush defending his brother, he pointed out something like $6 trillion were wasted, and that money could have been spent on roads and bridges and airports and infrastructure here back home in America. And frankly, I found that refreshing. I wish that more politicians would point out that obvious fact. And it seems to me that, and by the way, the only one that does is Bernie Sanders. It would seem to me that that kind of rhetoric resonates.
I fully agree with you. I have been struck by how much there has been a failure to fully place responsibility for the problems that have occurred since in the Mideast on both the invasion of Iraq leading up to it and the immediate administration of Iraq following it, the de-bathification. There's a ton of material. I've been looking at that Trump could use and make that case even stronger, and it is quite refreshing to see someone, in this case a Republican, raising that issue. Frankly, I wish he would raise it significantly more, because I think it's something that really needs exploration and examination, and really shows the roots of our difficulties there.
But in terms of the analysis that you provide in your piece, Thomas Edsel, about who Trump is appealing to and who, in effect, the new Republicans or those that are setting the agenda, there is the Republican that you quoted, John Feary, believes that Democrats have made gains amongst well-educated and relatively affluent whites, while Republicans have to rely more and more on the white working class than on white upper middle class voters. And so is that seems to be a pretty detectable trend, isn't it?
I mean, it's a reversal of what the two parties were back in the Depression and New Deal era under Franklin Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, and even to LBJ. The Democratic Party was the white working class party overwhelmingly. Now, people who are defined the way it's currently defined as whites without college degrees, they are really the strongest Republican constituency compared to whites with college degrees, and especially whites with postgraduate degrees are very Democratic. The professional class has become, which used to be a solidly Republican constituency, has now become close to a reliably Democratic constituency, whereas the white working class has been discussed extensively, has shifted to the right and has joined the Republican Party and has been absolutely crucial to their victories.
So does that mean then that Ronald Reagan was prescient in going after the Reagan Democrats?
Oh, no question. Not just Reagan. Nixon did it too with the silent majority. Then again in 1994 after Reagan with the angry white men. It's been a theme in Republican politics, and those voters are really what gave a party that was known as the Party of Wall Street the muscle to actually win elections. These white working class voters, first in the South, but also considerably in the North, have been the moving voters. They moved from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party, and that movement was crucial to building a conservative majority for really from 1968 through, well, maybe into the 1990s.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Edsel, who's a professor of journalism at Columbia University. His column on demographic and strategic trends in American politics appears every Wednesday in the New York Times. And during the years leading up to the 2012 elections, he wrote for the New York Times as a weekly contributor to Campaign Stops. He's the author of Power and Money, writing about politics, the new politics of inequality. And his latest book is The Age of Austerity. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Can This Really Be Donald Trump's Republican Party? But just going back to Reagan and him winning over the so-called Reagan Democrats, he, of course, his policies were entirely dictated and shaped by the kitchen cabinet of millionaires and billionaires. And here you have a billionaire, Donald Trump, being the favorite of working-class white Americans. And then if he doesn't make it, the other guy who's trying to be a populist friend of the white working man, Ted Cruz, as much as he goes after Wall Street and et cetera, his wife is a banker with Goldman Sachs. I mean, so it doesn't seem to matter that there's any authenticity in who this person is as long as they have the rhetoric.
Well, in fairness, it's a complex situation. One, Reagan came along after the Carter years. You may not want to blame Carter for this, but the Carter years were when interest rates went up to 19%, inflation was running rampant, there was this concept of the misery index, it was the period of globalization, and American industry was collapsing under competition from Germany and Japan. American workers, especially the white working class, felt in that period that the Democratic Party was not protecting them from the forces at work internationally, nationally, and Reagan was able to come in and assert that he was going to protect them. It was also a time when the Democratic Party was more closely aligned with what you can call identity politics, particularly race and gender politics. Those race and gender politics, many white working class voters felt, excluded them, that they were not the beneficiaries of affirmative action. If anything, they were the ones who paid the costs of affirmative action. So that in a certain sense, there was a movement away from the Democratic Party that the Republicans were able to capitalize on. So it's really the failure of the Democratic Party to maintain its support for not just whites, but working class people generally during this whole period that still continues to today. And a lot of people lost faith in the Democratic Party as their protector, which it had been throughout the New Deal, Great Depression, 1930s, 40s, 50s, and into the early 60s. So there's two sides to the problem, put it that way.
Right, but as you point out, Thomas Edsel, that Donald Trump is able to capitalize on the disquiet amongst white working class Americans over political correctness, which he trashes, yes, along with immigration, both of which the dog whistle there is pretty clear, is that, and a lot of statistics bear it out, that the more undocumented cheap labor that you bring into the United States, you know, it used to be that every carpenter and plumber and builder in America was a white man, and now, you know, contractors use undocumented labor because it's cheaper. And so he's exploiting that disquiet, surely, and tying it into political correctness.
He is, there's no question. And I was really struck. I didn't get into that in the piece, but I looked up some of the data, poll data on political correctness, and that phrase has overwhelmingly negative connotations to majorities of not just Republicans, but also of independents and Democrats. 62% of Democrats complain that there is too much political correctness. Now, what people mean by that can vary, but it is a surprisingly bigger issue than people realize. And if I note in the debate last night, the Republican candidates used the word political correctness at least 10 times, and I would guess more. I was going to check that. But it was striking how they know that Donald Trump has tapped into something, and that phrase is a very volatile one and a very effective tool in campaigning.
So if you have a Republican Party that's largely being captured by the Donald Trumps, and the most reliable constituency along with the Christian fundamentalists is now the white working class Americans, what happens then to your traditional Chamber of Commerce type Republicans? Where do they go?
Well, they, that's a good question. If it is captured, it's conceivable you could have, I'm not suggesting this is likely, but it's conceivable you could have the fracturing of the party, and it may be that the party has reached a breaking point with the establishment wing versus the populist wing, or whatever you want to call it. The Christian right is not that dissident at this point, not as much as this white working class segment. And the establishment has been able to work with the Christian right so far without this kind of crisis. Whether there would be a real... Well, the real thing is what's going to happen at the convention. And it's not just the votes on the convention floor, but it's also going to be the fight in the week beforehand in the Republican Platform Committee. They're going to have to decide what their economic policies are going to be. And that's going to be a very interesting testing ground. And then the fight, if the Trump forces continue to be strong enough to force an actual vote at the convention, that's going to be another real signal of where the Republican Party is likely to be going or the problems that it's really going to face. As that guy that I use as my lead, John Feary, says, he doesn't know what the solution to this is going to be. And I think a lot of Republicans, including the others who were quoted in the article, are really feeling a dilemma at this point.
Well, but you conclude your article by pointing out that there's kind of the damned if they do and the damned if they don't. The choices might well end up being either a deadlock convention in Cleveland in July or Donald Trump launching a third-party bid.
No question. Yeah. It wouldn't. The party rules, as I understand them, only oblige the delegates to vote for the candidate who won in their area for the first ballot, and then after that, they're free. Many of these delegates will be obligated to vote for Trump, but they won't be Trump supporters. They will be people who are selected by the party or their members of Congress and their super delegates. They would be free on a second ballot to jump from Trump to someone else. But if they did that and Trump had gone in with a substantial plurality, the anger at getting rebuffed that way would be pretty intense.
Well, Thomas Etzel, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Etzel. He's a professor of journalism at Columbia University. His column on demographic and strategic trends in American politics appears every Wednesday in the New York Times, and during the year leading up to the 2012 elections, he wrote for the New York Times as a weekly contributor to Campaign Stops. He's the author of Power and Money, Writing About Politics, The New Politics of Inequality, and his latest book is The Age of Austerity. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Can This Really Be Donald Trump's Republican Party? We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the deep state or the double government that runs the daily business of national security, rendering those we elect in our faux democracy largely as ornamentation.
Fooling on the human population.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Glennon, a professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's been legal counsel to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and a Fulbright Distinguished Professor of International and Constitutional Law at Vytautas Magnus University School of Law in Lithuania, and a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington. Professor Glennon has served as a consultant to various congressional committees, the U.S. State Department, and the International Atomic Energy Agency, and his latest book just out is National Security and Double Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Glennon.
Ian, it's a pleasure to be with you.
And somebody that I know and I've interviewed a number of times who served in the Obama administration as the deputy to Richard Holbrooke, Vali Nasser, who's now the dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. In plugging your book, he says, National Security and Double Government is an important and insightful book. It should be read by anyone concerned that Obama's national security policies differ so little from those of the Bush administration and by every incoming president and her staff. So I was amused by that. But in the context of what happened last night with the CNN Republican presidential primary debate, when you think about the incoming presidents or the potential presidents, I must say it's pretty alarming. I know you didn't watch it, but I had to watch it. And it was pretty shocking how much they basically endorse the double government, the deep state, top secret America, as Dana Priest called it. And, you know, it sort of reinforces your argument that this double government is not only is it being perpetuated, it's being, in this case, it's being perpetuated with vigor and energy and a complete blind disregard for basically what you're writing.
Well, that's, as you say, Ian, basically the premise of the book, that we've developed two sets of institutions, a set of Madisonian institutions, as I call them in the book, Congress, the president, and the courts, that the people think make and formulate national security policy, but it's in fact made by a set of institutions far removed from the public eye, that consists of the several hundred individuals who are the managers of the national security apparatus, the military and intelligence agencies, law enforcement agencies, and it's an enormous bureaucracy. There are now 46 different federal intelligence, law enforcement, security agencies that are involved in these activities. 2,000 private corporations that are located in 10,000 different places in the United States. There's an annual budget of about $1 trillion. Nobody really knows. It's classified. The manpower is somewhere in the realm of, we don't know that either, but it consists of millions of people. There are 5 million people in the country now who have security clearances. And this apparatus dominates the formulation of national security policy. Congress and the president and the courts all defer to it.
Well, if we have this kind of faux democracy, and frankly, if you watch the Republican presidential debate last night, it would be better described as a kind of game show democracy. But is that to say that our elected officials are sort of democratic ornaments? They come and go. How much are they, first of all, surprised by what they find out when they finally get into that Oval Office? And how much are they captured?
I don't think that's a persuasive explanation. Some people do describe Obama as having been so surprised that that's really the explanation for the continuity of so many different elements of the Bush administration policy. But when you look at those policies one after the next, it simply is not plausible to think that every one of the policies in question was the single most rational response to the problem at hand. I mean, the continuity is overwhelming. Drone strikes, offensive cyber weapons, whistleblower prosecutions. Obama's decision to continue the Bush policy of not prosecuting torturers, bulk surveillance by the NSA, CIA covert operations, invoking the state secrets privilege. There are a dozen, two dozen other examples. And so it's just not plausible to think that every one of those policies was the best or the most rational response to the very real national security threats that we're confronting. Obviously, there's something else going on. And I think that the answer, unfortunately, is that we've lapsed into, without any intent, we've lapsed into this structure of double government.
But in terms of the fear of the enemy, real or imagined, that effectively drives a national security, at least it justifies national security in a very basic way, the stuff that we're dealing with now with terrorist attacks in Paris and out here in San Bernardino, and then, of course, just yesterday, all of the L.A. schools were closed based upon an overreaction to a hoax. My sense is that what we need in terms of our national security debate, short of the deeper remedies that you're talking about in your book, but just on the surface, what we seem to need is not for Obama to man up, as the Republicans are accusing him of being feckless, but to essentially, you know, tell us, the American people, it's time to grow up. Why is the most powerful nation on the earth, why does it have its chain jerked all the time by obscure actors in the Middle East?
Well, I think the central problem really is that the American people have no independent basis on which to judge the lethality of threats from organizations such as ISIS. And they're, as a result, forced, because of the absence of any alternatives, to take the Pentagon's, the CIA's, the NSA's word for it. They have to rely upon the managers of the national security apparatus to tell them the truth about the extent to which these threats are lethal and the way in which they need to be met. And the problem is there's, of course, an inherent conflict of interest. I mean, it's like having an oak tree in your yard that seems unhealthy, so you call the arbor and asks if it needs to be replaced. That person is in the business of replacing oak trees, so there's a very strong incentive to say, yes, of course it needs to be replaced, and I'm just the person to do it. Well, you ask that question of the CIA and the Pentagon and NSA, how great is this threat? Naturally, they're going to have an incentive to inflate the threat, because if they're wrong, what's the cost? Well, they get a bigger budget, more manpower. There's no downside. And that's the fundamental problem. All this information is classified, and the American people have no real way to assess the validity of the evaluations that they get from the national security apparatus.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Glennon, who's a professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's been a legal counsel to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and a Fulbright Distinguished Professor of International and Constitutional Law at Vytautas Magnus University School of Law in Lithuania and a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. Professor Glennon has served as a consultant to various congressional committees, the U.S. State Department, and the International Atomic Energy Agency, and his latest book just out is National Security and Double Government. So in terms of double government and the deep state, you're saying that essentially the Madisonian institutions, that's the president, the Congress, and the courts, are sort of decoration, if you will, that the president, his control of it is minimal or nominal, and oversight in Congress is completely dysfunctional. And I suspect that one of the reasons why Obama seems to be comfortable with national security as opposed to domestic issues is he can't get anything done with the latter. But the other point, and the other point you make, is that judicial review is negligible. But then you say that the other side, if you will, the problem is the Trumanites. In my reading of Truman in terms of the 1947 National Security Act that he signed, was that Harry Truman actually had some deep misgivings about it, and he told his aides, particularly with the creation of the CIA, I don't want to create some goddamn American Gestapo. I'm pretty sure that that's an accurate quote.
Well, that's right. I think he expressed those misgivings to his top aide, Clark Clifford. And you're quite right. I think the origins trace back to the Truman administration, as I suggest in the book, National Security Act of 1947, which created the CIA and consolidated power in the military. And then in 1952, Truman secretly signed an executive order setting up the National Security Agency. The time these things were being done, there's a very interesting political inversion. The criticism and the concerns were expressed by conservative Republicans in the House and the Senate, who suggested that Truman was leading the United States into a garrison state, that it was power-hungry, payroll-padding bureaucrats in the Pentagon who would benefit, that he was with the FBI and CIA, risk creating another Gestapo. And it was liberal Democrats like Hubert Humphrey in the Senate and Paul Douglas of Illinois in the Senate who came to Truman's defense and suggested that it was necessary to meet Stalin's threats anywhere that they arose, and that we needed this enormous defense intelligence apparatus to do that. Of course, everything has inverted to an extent today, but the Congress has become, as you say, largely ceremonial in the formulation of national security policy, because this apparatus has just come to dominate the whole thing, and everybody, the courts, the president, and the Congress defer to it.
So, in terms of reversing this deeply metastasized situation with the double government or the deep state so deeply buried, your suggestion is that it essentially requires that the institutions that are being sort of bypassed or have become irrelevant, what you call the Madisonian institutes, they're the ones that have to reassert their authority. But I take it this is only going to come from pressure from the public, right? Because haven't these institutions been largely co-opted? I mean, if you, again, going back to last night's debate, those guys can't wait to spend more and more money, except with a few exceptions like Rand Paul. They just simply cannot wait to throw money at the Pentagon and therefore, you know, feed the double government even more.
That's the pessimistic conclusion of the book. The government is the problem, and you can't look to hollowed out institutions, the congressional oversight committees, the courts, and even the presidency itself, to get control of these national security departments and agencies. There's a very deeply embedded structure of incentives that causes them all to continue to defer to the national security bureaucracy. The Congress continues to naturally seek re-election above all else, and they're responsive to very powerful constituencies. Judges are inclined to decide in favor of the people who appointed them. The president and his staff all defer to the expertise of the military and the intelligence communities. Even the press is motivated primarily by maintaining access to these people and drumming up viewership and listeners. President of CBS the other day was quoted as saying, "Go Trump," not because he's in favor of Trump ideologically or politically, but because Trump is good for business. These institutions like CBS thrive on controversy and drama. And so all these different structural incentives come together in a kind of perfect storm. And the ultimate result is this structure of double government. It's more complicated than that, but that's basically the dynamic.
So given that the national security policy is essentially conducted by this shadow government of bureaucrats and it's supported by think tanks. Whether it doesn't matter whether it's the American Enterprise Institute or the Center for American Progress at the end of the day. And then you've got the media, as you say. I mean, nobody was more in favor of Bush and Cheney's disastrous Gulf War than CNN. They even developed a theme music, I recall. So, and of course, you've got the policy wonks, particularly the very aggressive neoconservatives, who brought about this entire Middle East disaster that we're dealing with now. So if the permanent government or the permanent national security establishment defeats every president's efforts to chart a new course, I mean, does that make us susceptible? I made the point earlier about how our chain gets jerked by Middle East actors, some of which are totally obscure. If you look at the record just in a cursory way, you could make the case that Sirhan Sirhan, an obscure Palestinian, decided that Bobby Kennedy wasn't going to become president and Richard Nixon was. You can make the case that the Ayatollah Khomeini, who nobody had ever heard of until he suddenly appeared on television, he decided that Jimmy Carter's presidency was over and helped elect Ronald Reagan. And you can go through all these other characters like Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. They've clearly affected the political landscape. So my question is, does America and the American people and the government, including the double government, control our political destiny, or are they always whipsawed by foreign actors?
Well, that's an important question. And it's important for me to emphasize that the theory of double government, which is, by the way, one that was developed in the 1860s to explain the operation of the British Constitution, the theory recognizes the importance of exceptions, which is to say, obviously you can point to examples of important national security decisions in which Congress or the courts or the president play a dominant role. You have to have those counterexamples, or the public would recognize that the system is rigged. And those counterexamples have to occur with sufficient frequency to cause people, you know, not to get up from a poker table thinking that the dealer is playing with a marked deck. You need those exceptions, and there are plenty of them. But the bottom line is, there's no conspiracy. This is not a situation in which some dark group with nefarious intent has wrested control of the government from the Madisonian institutions. No, it's a situation in which, as I say, we have as a nation drifted unintentionally into this bifurcated system in which, while there are exceptions, national security policy tends to be formulated as a rule by bureaucrats who are not subject to the same principles of democratic accountability that apply to Congress and the presidency.
So the fact that today I think we spend as much money, if not more, than we spent at the height of the Cold War, and during the Cold War, we had a real enemy in the sense that the Soviet Union could destroy the United States physically. Every American city was targeted around the clock, and within 30 minutes, they would have been vaporized, and most of the population would have been killed, or they'd die later, and the country, if not the world, would have ended. And that was a real threat, and there was a hair trigger. And, you know, mercifully and miraculously, it all went away. But the defense budget didn't go away. So the fact that now this entire defense budget is devoted to this ridiculously inflated threat of a bunch of crazy guys in the Middle East driving around in these Mad Max pickup trucks, holding their black flags in the breeze and cutting people's heads off. I mean, the fact that we've gone from a real threat to this sort of imagined threat, and yet the same amount of money is being applied or devoted to the same security system, I take it that reinforces your point, that there's a kind of autopilot quality to this.
Autopilot, it's curious you use that word. That was precisely the word, as you may know, that John Kerry applied to the NSA wiretap on Angela Merkel's phone when President Obama said he didn't know anything about it. Kerry's explanation was, well, this is a program that's just on autopilot. And unfortunately, that same word applies to very many of the programs that we're talking about. President Obama, when it came to CIA drone strikes in Pakistan, told his staff, the CIA gets what it wants. Don't question what we're doing. And it's all part of this enormous apparatus that has just grown tremendously since World War II. And I think you make a point that the American people don't really appreciate over the last 10 years the defense budget of this country has grown 67% in real terms. It is now 50% higher than it was for an average year during the Cold War. We're spending today greater than the total combined spending of the next 20 largest military powers combined. And, of course, as you say, there's no adversary anything like the Soviet Union that we're confronting today. 75% of NATO's military budget is spent by the United States. And the question is whether the threats are anything close to being commensurate with that level of expenditure, and I think the answer is clearly not.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Michael Glennon, going back to the end of the Cold War under George H.W. Bush, Bush Sr., there was a sort of talk of a peace dividend. What happened there? Did the double government sort of double down, if you will, or did the people, the press, and our politicians fail us by saying, okay, now it's time to invest in America? And there was, by the way, there was some talk about that last night from, of all people, Donald Trump, who said, you know, we wasted $6 trillion in the Middle East. That money could have been spent on roads and bridges and airports and infrastructure in this country that's all falling apart. I think people recognize that. So why did that argument not prevail?
Well, it did prevail to an extent. Defense spending did go down after the end of the Cold War momentarily. It was 9/11, of course, that turned things around. And it was the fear that following 9/11 that drove the return to these higher military budgets. But up until through the first decade of the new century, military spending on the part of the United States was way down from Cold War levels.
Well, Michael Glennon, I thank you very much for joining us and for your book, National Security and Double Government.
Well, Ian, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Glennon, who's a professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's been a legal counsel to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and a Fulbright Distinguished Professor of International and Constitutional Law at Vytautas Magnus University School of Law in Lithuania and a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. Professor Glennon has served as a consultant to various congressional committees, the U.S. State Department, and the International Atomic Energy Agency, and his latest book, Just out is National Security and Double Government. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the attack on consumer protection in the omnibus spending bill making its way through Congress.
For the riders.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Laurie Wallach, who's the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of the non-profit watchdog group Public Citizen. She's an expert on the operations and outcomes of trade policies such as NAFTA, WTO, CAFTA, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She works closely with Congress, scholars, and activists in the U.S. and developing countries to foster the growing debate about the implications of different models of globalization on jobs, offshoring, wages, the environment, public health and food safety, equality and social justice, and democratically accountable governance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laurie Wallach.
Thank you very much.
And this omnibus spending bill making its way through Congress, where lots and lots of ideological riders have been piled on, many of them have been stripped out. A lot of them are policies that would never pass in the daylight, that would never pass in the normal process of government, but because when they have a must-pass spending bill, they're able to load them in and slip them in. And obviously, I want to talk to you about the issues involving the origins of meat labels for pork and beef that are in this, that have been slipped in. But just in the broader context, it seems that the two worst riders, in a way, are to do with campaign finance or eviscerating what's left of campaign finance. They've slipped in a rider that halts the IRS's rulemaking ability and delays it for a whole year so that they won't be able to look into these 501c4s, these phony vehicles that allow money to go into politics without attribution. And then they create these instruments during elections and then they dissolve them after elections. And the other one, of course, is an SEC rider that would stop the rulemaking in the agency to demand that big corporations disclose their political spending. And that, of course, has been removed, too. So is that, to your mind, the priority of our Congress to corrupt our politics even more with more money and less disclosure?
Well, these omnibus must-pass bills become just the most dangerous moments for undermining our democracy because, effectively, a lot of things, as you said, that couldn't make it through in public get superglued onto this bill. And this one just kind of opens up a whole box of Pandora's. I mean, those two issues are disgusting. And it, add to that, for instance, getting rid of the ban we've had for decades on the export of petroleum, which is going to make, for us consumers, gasoline prices higher, but also creates all kinds of new incentives for more oil and gas exploration as compared to on the sort of, you know, day after the climate conference, the prospect of incentivizing non-petroleum energy markets. And also in there are a whole set of other issues, some of them just really unrelated to government spending at all. I mean, you talked about cutting off money to basically not be able to fund certain programs. But, you know, the other issue you raised was they just literally, in another part of the bill, it's not about money, they just literally wiped out the country of origin mandatory meat labels that we all rely on. Everyone, when you go to the grocery store and you can see on the steak, on the hamburger, on the bacon, where it came from, this is it. The Congress just used this must-pass bill to wipe that out because the World Trade Organization told us we weren't allowed as consumers to have that information. And in the face of a billion dollars of trade sanctions against the U.S. authorized by the WTO for every year, unless and until we get rid of the country of origin meat labels that have gone through our courts and been successfully reviewed, no problem with the U.S. courts, we're going to hit the trade sanctions, so Congress used this bill to get rid of them.
Well, I want to talk to you more about this, of course, but you did touch on the gift to big oil, where big oil, we're talking about the repeal of a 40-year-old limit on exporting U.S.-produced crude oil. This is going to, of course, have the effect of raising gasoline prices for the American consumer in the years ahead, while giving a $30 billion annual windfall profit to U.S. oil producers. So that is an extraordinary, I think it tells you where the priorities are. And again, as I say, eviscerating campaign finance is obviously a priority. Taking the burden away from corporate America to disclose their political spending in advertising so that you can a big corporation, if they want to get into the political arena, they should be able to disclose at the end of a commercial, this politician brought to you by ExxonMobil, that's been killed. So let's talk further about the country of origin labeling. Who does it benefit? Is this not necessarily showing fealty to the beef and pork producers here in the United States?
Well, interestingly, it kind of is. I mean, this particular incident is a very high-profile example of how trade agreements get used to undermine domestic environmental and consumer standards. Because the backstory of this one is, for almost 50 years, the consumer movement, as well as some independent beef and pork producers, have sought mandatory of country of origin labeling. So if consumers want to choose American beef, pork, poultry, etc., they have the information to make informed choices. And the packing industry, the slaughterhouses, agribusiness, the grocery stores, they were adamantly against it, as well as some of the big agribusiness cattle producers, where they like the idea of being able to take, say, a steer born in the U.S., have it fattened cheaper in Mexico, bring it back here for slaughter, or have it fattened here, slaughtered in Mexico, or labor is cheaper. And then we as American consumers are none the wiser about the safety standards, the origin, et cetera. And what ended up happening is that the industry, not the ma and pa cow and calf producer ranchers, but the packing guys, the grocery store guys, they basically tried both to get Congress not to pass this law. Then they sued in U.S. courts and said it wasn't allowable. It had to be thrown out. Congress went with the consumers. The court said it was fine. And then they went to Plan B. And they basically recruited their counterparts in Mexico and Canada, the packing houses, and they got them to use the World Trade Organization rules to basically deregulate by trade pact attack what they couldn't achieve in domestic courts or in Congress. And that whole process started in 2011 with the first ruling from the WTO saying our laws violated our WTO rules. These laws that our court said were fine, that weren't discriminatory, because, those labels apply no matter where the meat is processed, where the animal is born and raised. It just, you have to say where. It's not like the American producers don't have to do the same paperwork. Everyone has to.
But we've had recent outbreaks. The Chipotle fast food chain are really being severely impacted. And, one wonders whether it's somebody's trying to destroy Chipotle with germ warfare. But if you can't determine the country of origin, and people get E. coli and start getting sick and dropping dead in large numbers, I mean that's absurd, isn't it? I mean, the fact of the matter is they're having a hard time keeping up with this Chipotle outbreak, and that's apparently happening here in the United States, even though they don't seem to be able to get a handle on it. It keeps breaking out in different parts of the country.
Right. I mean, the part of this outrageous revocation of the law, because a trade agreement told us to, is it applies to hamburger, to ground pork and ground beef, which is the most dangerous of the dangerous when you want to know where something comes from. Because without these rules, there's no incentive for the packing houses or the grocery stores not to have hamburger, for instance, that commingles different ground beef deliveries from scores of different countries, who knows what ends up in your hamburger patty? If the law requires, which it did until this bill gets passed, that you know where the animal was raised, where it was born, and where it was slaughtered in the ground beef, it means you're going to have beef that is, for instance, got a label that says North America or the U.S. or says Brazil, and you know, and it's going to be segregated. So when you find out there's some outbreak relating to X country, you can go back and say, all right, as a consumer, you can say, not sure I want to buy the meat from that country. They're obviously having problems. But also just tracking it back, you don't have the commingled hamburger. You actually have the hamburger that you can say, this is not mystery meat with, you know, one cut of beef from 20 different countries turned into one hamburger. And that basic information is what we're seeing a trade agreement take away from us. But, you know, the thing of it is, Warren, it's not brand new. The president's just flat out wrong himself when he says trade agreements can't do that. Because you'll recall, because you are one of the few journalists who's reported on this over the years, the WTO has also resulted past of these announcements where they're, you know, in this case, it's $1 billion of trade sanctions every year. So in the past, we've gotten rid of we've weakened the CAFE standards, the corporate average fuel economy, the fuel efficiency standards for automobiles. We've gotten rid of Endangered Species Act rules that were protective of endangered sea turtles. We've weakened those. We've also gotten rid of the ban on tuna fish that was caught using nets that drowned dolphins. We hadn't, you know, we just didn't allow it in anymore. And we got to get rid of the ban, and then we were allowed to label it. And then guess what? 2 weeks ago, the WTO also said we had to get rid of the labels. So here we have a whole panoply of trade agreements already telling us we're not allowed to have basic environmental consumer laws. And then if you look at the new TPP text, to pick up on your point, as concerned as I was as a recovering trade attorney looking at the leaked chapters, I was actually flabbergasted at how much worse some of the chapters were than the rumors of what was in them. Because, for instance, in the food safety chapter, it allows a whole new set of challenges that go beyond the constraints in the WTO. So the WTO rules are worrying enough, as we're noticing by those cases we're talking about. But consider this. The TPP would newly allow challenges on border inspection rules or even holding stuff that's suspected of contamination at the border for any period of time to have it tested can be subject to a challenge. Inspection sampling rules, like no one particular country or company has had problems historically. So, of course, you have more testing of that stuff. You don't go after the countries that are doing okay or the companies that are doing okay. You want to check the stuff that you worry might not be okay. Those kind of, as I call it, discriminations in the text wouldn't be allowed. So imagine already we know we have this problem, and then the TPP would make it much worse.
Well, Laurie Wallach, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And folks, if you care about this issue, they're voting on Friday. So if you have a view, you've got until Friday to talk to your members of the House and the Senate. They're both voting on Friday.
And that means let your fingers do the talking and light a fire under your congressman and senator. Again, I've been speaking with Laurie Wallach, who's the founder and director of Global Trade Watch, a division of the nonprofit watchdog group Public Citizen. She's an expert on the operations and outcomes of trade policies such as NAFTA, WTO, CAFTA, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She works closely with Congress, scholars, and activists in the U.S. and developing countries to foster the growing debate about the implications of different models of globalization on jobs, offshoring, wages, the environment, public health, and food safety, equality and social justice, and democratically accountable governance. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.